Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, the week that was, and it was quite a week, a telemarketer like you have never, ever heard. And also, if you liked it, you should have put a ring on it. Beyonce is back from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount helps us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 13th of December. Good as always to have you with us. It is the end of a week in which we saw new rules for the financial markets, compromise of a budgetary nature in Congress, some other economic odds and ends as well. So we are going to get going today with the week that was. For that, we've got Felix Salmon from Reuters. He is actually in Los Angeles today while I am in New York. Catherine Rampell from the New York Times is with us as well. Hey, guys.
Good afternoon.
How do you like the new studios, Felix? Pretty nice, huh?
New studio smell. It's lovely.
That's right. All right. So let me, Catherine, start with you and ask you, which is more significant for the future of the American economy of the events that happened this week? The Volcker Rule, the new rules for the financial markets, or the budget compromise in Washington? Which is a bigger deal?
I think there are still a lot of open questions about the Volcker Rule and exactly how tightly it'll be enforced. So I'm going to cop out and say, well, we know a bit more about the budgetary plan. So in that respect, you know, it's a more tangible effect anyway.
All right, fair enough. Felix, same question to you.
We also know that the budget plan is going to have zero effect from 2016 onwards. It's just a very short-term budgetary stopgap, whereas the Volcker Rule is going to exist in perpetuity. So if you take the long view, I'm going to say the Volcker Rule.
All right, perpetuity is a long time. Do you not actually think, Felix, that they're going to figure out ways to take care of the sequester, which is what, you know, the budget deal did, in the out years after 2016?
Well, I hope, sincerely hope, that this is not the way they do it, by putting together little two-year plans and cobbling them together sequentially. Like when one runs out, they'll put in the next one. That's the absolute worst way of doing it.
No. The absolute worst way is the way they've been doing it for the past three, 4 years.
True that. As long as you manage to avoid the debt ceiling craziness and the government shutdowns, then you're better than the sort of standard dysfunction. Right. But can't we just have a grown-up government for once?
No. I'm sorry. We can't do that. Catherine, here's the question, though. Does this deal, baby steps though it may have been, does it not open the way for substantive discussion on issues of conscience for these parties? Entitlement, Social Security and welfare, debt limit, those kinds of things.
One would hope, but they still haven't addressed the debt limit issue. I mean, that was one of the big question marks that we still have about these budget discussions that people had hoped would be answered already. So, I'm not sure that there's reason to hope that this will get resolved in perpetuity anytime soon. It'll, again, probably be something that just keeps on getting pushed, you know, maybe temporarily patched and then pushed off. Mm-hmm. Other issues, you know, entitlements are still very much a third rail. That's the thing that, you know, probably has the biggest long-term impact on our budget, particularly healthcare anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's very uncomfortable for either party to talk about it without alienating a lot of their base.
Felix, I wonder what your take is on the space that this has given us to deal with some of these more important issues.
As Catherine says, the number one thing we should do, because it's incredibly easy, is just abolish the debt ceiling. Every party which has ever been in the White House, which is both of them, will agree, if they've ever been in the White House, that we should abolish this debt ceiling. If they can't do that, the chances of them being able to do anything else which makes sense have got to be pretty slim.
All right. I'm going to take a sort of a sideways turn here and raise a name in macroeconomic circles and economic policy circles that we haven't actually talked about a lot. But this week, the name of Stanley Fischer was raised as a possible vice chair to Janet Yellen at the Federal Reserve. He is coming out of a stint running the central bank in Israel. Felix, do you think that's going to matter in terms of Fed policy for the next, you know, couple of years if he does, in fact, get that nod?
First, it has to be said, Stan Fischer is a monetary policy demigod. You can't get any more respected than Stan Fischer.
He was Ben Bernanke's PhD thesis
and Larry Summers' advisor, right. And Mario Draghi's. You name it, they've all been taught by Stan Fischer. So if he goes on to the Fed automatically becomes that much more respected. No one's going to be second-guessing, going, we know better than what Stan Fischer is doing. If Stan Fischer agrees in public with Janet Yellen, those two have stronger monetary policy credentials than any other pair of central bankers you can think of.
Catherine, you think so?
Yeah, I mean, he's certainly very, very well respected. He's sort of the ancestor, the father figure for a lot of the other central bankers today. And so I think markets seem to like him. They kind of know what he's about. And he's likely to be supportive of Yellen's leadership. So, I don't envision a whole lot of dysfunction coming from his getting.
Which
that
is a plus with
case.
The central bank. Which is a plus. Catherine Rampell from the New York Times, Felix Salmon from Reuters. Have a good weekend, you guys. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Kay.
Thanks, Kay.
All right, bye bye. On Wall Street today, things were all right. You know, come see, come saw. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I got off the plane from L.A. last night about midnight, maybe 1 in the morning East Coast time. Flipped on my phone after 5 hours offline, only to find that my Twitter feed had pretty much blown up Beyoncé all over the place, which was kind of unusual, actually, since there's mostly a whole lot of economics and finance in my Twitter feed. Not so much divas, if you know what I mean. As we all know now, Beyoncé released her fifth album last night called Simply Beyoncé. Just put it out there on iTunes. She did no heads up, no multi-million dollar ad campaign, no top 40 stations playing a few singles to death before we could buy the thing. And you know what? None of that really mattered because she is already at the top of the charts. Marketplace's David Gura was doing the budget deal yesterday. Today, he's on the Beyoncé beat.
It dropped at midnight.
We wake up on Friday the 13th and we get a present.
Stephanie Keller teaches in the business and management program at the Berklee College of Music.
How fabulous is that?
In this day and age, a surprise like this one is rare. What I'm viewing is a little different. Michael Wood covers music for the LA Times and he calls Queen Bee a master of the non-disclosure agreement.
The one person you don't want to cross is Beyoncé.
You got that? Wood says this album stands out when you compare it to releases by Katy Perry and Lady Gaga.
These albums are the sort of end point of a humongous multi-prong campaign with concerts and TV appearances and et cetera, et cetera.
Not so for Beyoncé. Wood says that as great as this is for B, it's as great for iTunes. It's the only place to buy the album right now, and you can't buy the songs a la carte. So is this upending anything? Should we expect a surprise album from another artist? John Rose used to be the head of strategy at EMI.
To make something like that work, you have to have the kind of overarching followership and engagement that Beyoncé and only a handful of artists have.
Beyoncé announced this album on Instagram, where she has more than 8 million followers. Beyoncé follows no one. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Beyoncé and budgets, Gura can do it all. All right, listen, not that I meant to turn this into the Twitter segment of the program, but there is news of a rebellion of sorts in the Twitterverse. And yes, I hate that phrase too, but it does kind of apply here. Twitter announced a change to its blocking policy yesterday, the ways that one can block, basically, unwanted followers. Suffice it to say, the new rules didn't allow for all that much blocking, which upset a whole lot of Twitter users worried about stalkers and harassment. It upset enough of them so that the company went back to its old policy in less than a day. Marketplace's David Weinberg looks at the power of we the users in this age of social media.
Never before have people been able to give feedback to a business so quickly and in such volume. Sometimes that feedback is positive, but when it's negative, it puts companies on the spot in a very public way.
Maybe that feedback signals to the company, okay, well, we've got to explain this better. We've got to educate our customers and make them understand why this is for the best.
Dr. Andrew Stephen teaches at the Katz School of Business at the University of Pittsburgh. In Twitter's case, it chose not to explain why it thinks the new blocking policy is good for users. It just reversed the policy. Another example of this sort of reversal is when Gap unveiled its new logo. People hated it. They said so on the internet and poof, gone was the new logo. Companies are now under pressure to respond to feedback as it comes in.
And I don't know if that's always positive.
Stephen Walls is a senior lecturer at the McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas. He says fear over social media backlash can mean companies lose their ability to explain themselves, and it makes it difficult to do things like experiment with a new policy.
Certainly for companies, it does create this amplification system, for better or for worse.
It can mean free word-of-mouth advertising or a sudden crisis. And this is the delicate balance that companies like Twitter have to maneuver as they deal with issues of user security and privacy.
Which is especially difficult since we're changing how we feel about that probably on a daily basis.
I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
There's a lot that happens in an economy when home prices rise like they have been. Homeowners just feel like they've got more net worth. People regain equity in their homes that they lost during the crash. But the housing bust ain't entirely over. By some estimates, about 15% of mortgage holders are still underwater. That is, they owe more on their homes than the homes themselves are worth. That comes to a collective $400 billion across the economy. And there are relief programs those homeowners could turn to, but looking for help could mean an unexpected tax bill, as Kate Davidson reports.
Real estate broker Fernando Herboso thinks it's unfair that a law called the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act expires this month. He remembers how hard it was for underwater borrowers before the law passed. As the market crashed, they were calling him, saying,
Fernando, I'm having problems paying. I don't know what to do.
Soon he was helping his clients with short sales in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. Let's say a client owed $300,000 on her home but could only sell it for $200,000. He'd explain that in a short sale.
The bank then gives you an imaginary check for the other $100,000.
The lender forgives that mortgage debt.
Then the IRS sees that as an income. Somebody just gave you a check for $100,000, and you have to pay taxes for it.
In normal times, mortgage debt that's forgiven through short sale or loan modification is considered taxable income. But in late 2007, Congress recognized that people on the brink of foreclosure couldn't pay a hefty tax. So it passed the debt relief law, largely exempting canceled mortgage debt from taxation.
Early on, when this was passed, you could argue it simply wasn't a matter for individual households. It was a macroeconomic matter. We're at the point now where it's really not a macroeconomic matter.
Mark Calabria worked for the Senate Banking Committee when the act was passed. He's now at the Cato Institute. He says now that the worst is over, it's okay to let the law expire. He says we shouldn't create the wrong incentives.
You know, if you're underwriting somebody's losses on the housing market, then you're much more encouraging people to take risk in the housing market.
But David Stevens, head of the Mortgage Bankers Association, says parts of the country are still struggling.
And the problem with this is this will now create potentially an impediment for a borrower who could be offered a debt forgiveness program.
They'd get debt relief on the one hand and a tax bill in the other. Recent settlements with banks like JP Morgan Chase make more funds available to forgive mortgage debt. The question for Congress is whether taxing that help will force people to forego it. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Coming up, a robot that lies about being a robot.
What? No, I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
No, you're not a real person. But first, let's do the numbers. Here you go on a Friday. The Dow Industrials bumped up 15 points, about a 10%, 15,755. The NASDAQ gained 2 points today, not quite 0.1%. Finished at 4,000. The S&P 500 ended the day exactly where it started, 1775. For the week, down the S&P 500 both slipped 1.7%. The NASDAQ erased 1.5%. Adobe Systems climbed 12% today. Turns out the software maker had more online customers than expected. Electronic Arts powered up 6%. Its video games have been selling quite well, thank you very much, on the new Xbox and PlayStation consoles. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. To keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift in any amount supports your daily dose of business insight from Marketplace. So please help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve issues industrial production data for November. It's the anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. The saltwater tea was brewed on December 16, 1773. And 2 years later, on the same date, Jane Austen, author and creator of The Dashing Mr. Darcy, was born. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There will come a day when it's not newsworthy when a high-profile company hires a black woman. But as of right now, it still is. Saturday Night Live says it's going to add a female black cast member next year. It's been holding special auditions to find just the right person to join that iconic show that has been so white and so male for so long. Marketplace's Mark Garrison is live from New York on a Friday night.
SNL turned its lack of black women into a joke in a recent episode where guest host Kerry Washington had to play every black female role.
We agree this is not an ideal situation and look forward to rectifying it in the near future. Unless, of course, we fall in love with another white guy first.
Producers say they want to cast talented black females but can't find them. Comedian Chloe Hilliard says that's not quite right.
When they say there aren't any women that they've seen, what's really being said is we haven't seen people that impressed us where we have normally been looking.
The main places they look are the best-known improv comedy groups, UCB Theater, Second City, and The Groundlings. They're as white or whiter than SNL. Part of the reason the stages SNL scouts aren't diverse is economic.
But a lot of these places, they've become sort of these comedy factories. It's a pay-to-play scenario.
Comedian Cyrus McQueen points out that young comics have to pay for improv classes before they can get stage time. And even then, stage time usually doesn't pay. That makes for a tilted playing field. Comic Janae Johnson says many funny people of color can't afford to buy classes and then work for free.
As a young black person, when I'm fresh out of college, I have to go get a job, a real job, that will support me.
It seems the comedy scene doesn't just favor white people. It favors rich white people, at least until powerful producers look a little harder. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
More people than ever in this country are going to college. Full-time enrollment was up 45% over the past 10 years. That's according to the Department of Education. And that means a lot of kids showing up on campus are the first in their families to go to school. And a lot of them, it turns out, struggle to graduate. One idea that's catching on to help those students stick it out is separate dormitories. So from the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has this latest in her series, First in the Family.
In a basement lounge at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, a few dozen students line up for fried chicken with an array of international sauces, from Indian curry to British pineapple chutney. This is the Blanding 3 holiday party. About half the students in this dorm are the first in their families to go to college. They've chosen to live together, study together, and tonight make gingerbread houses together in a friendly competition.
Oh, why didn't we do that?
Oh my God, that would have been so much easier.
It really would have.
Cody Russell and Alejandra Sanchez attempt to hang tiny frosting icicles on their gingerbread roof.
I think you make a dot and then pull down.
Cody is from Taylor County, Kentucky, in the rural heart of the state. He was raised by a single mom. She worked at the Fruit of the Loom factory before it closed, then at an auto plant making side mirrors. He says watching her sometimes work two jobs and struggle to pay the bills, he was determined to go to college. But when he got here,
it was a complete culture shock. Went from a small town where everybody knew what you were doing and just the complete difference of high school work compared to college work and the load.
With its vast campus and almost 30,000 students, most freshmen would find UK daunting. The whole point of this dorm is to help them adjust. Students got to move in a few days early, so they bonded before classes even started. Older students, who are also the first in their families to go to college, serve as mentors.
So it makes this big university for a lot of us that came from small towns a little bit smaller and a little bit more like home.
The so-called first-generation living-learning community was created to address a crisis in Kentucky. The state has a smaller share of college graduates in the workforce than almost any other state. Here at UK, only about 22% of first-generation students finish in 4 years.
And only 46% are graduating in 6 years. So we're not serving our mission to educate the Commonwealth if we're sending half of those students home with a broken dream.
Matthew Defendahl is director of First Generation Initiatives at the university. He helped launch the program 2 years ago to keep more of those students coming back.
As we know from student development theory, if they make a connection to campus, they'll want to stay. So we thought, why not create a community of other students who were going through the same thing?
Students don't just live together. They have events and workshops focused on life skills and special staff advisors. And they take classes together, like UK 101 on how to navigate college life and this communications class.
All right, so a couple of quick housekeeping things before we get started. First of all, don't...
The night after the holiday party, many of the students were in a classroom together presenting digital projects. Professor Jamie Warren says students in the program seem to catch on more quickly than her other students.
I think a great deal of that probably comes from the fact that they're not only taking this course together, but they're also living together. So they do homework together, they have study sessions together.
In the first 2 years of the program, 92% of students have come back for their second year, compared to just over 72% of all first-generation students on campus. Director Matthew Defendahl says their grades are higher, too.
So they're performing stronger, they're being retained at a higher rate, and they're forming connections.
And they're not just changing their own futures, but their families. Josh Johnson came from Pikeville in eastern Kentucky, where college wasn't in the cards for most of his fellow students.
Most of them go straight in the workforce or go into coal because that's the main industry where I'm from. And I just want to have a better life for myself and my children.
His example has rubbed off on his younger brother. Josh is helping him apply for college now. But as programs like Kentucky's have cropped up on other campuses, some worry about isolating first-generation students. Richard Collenberg with the Century Foundation says one benefit of college is mixing with more advantaged students, and those connections pay off in career opportunities later in life.
And to the extent that colleges are encouraging low-income and first-generation students to socialize separately and apart from others, I think that's not doing those students any good.
Those in Kentucky's program say they meet lots of other students. And after the first year, most of them will live off campus or in other housing. Samantha Lamar from Erlanger, Kentucky, near Cincinnati, says having that home base has actually helped her branch out.
Since I got here and was able to kind of open up and meet new people and I started to feel comfortable, I was like, maybe I can say hi to the girl sitting next to me in my English class, or maybe I can join a group.
Or even lead one. She wants to be a resident advisor in the dorm next year to help other students make that transition. In Lexington, Kentucky, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The future of robocall telemarketing is upon us, and it sounds just like us. No more the tinny mechanical recording is designed to get us to buy or subscribe or otherwise part with our money. Denver Nix is a reporter with Time.com, and he is here to shed some light on a telemarketer who called herself Samantha West. Denver, thanks for joining us.
Good to be on.
This is a bizarre little tale. Run me through the basics, would you?
It's bizarre indeed. Our bureau chief, Michael Scher, got a phone call, a series of phone calls from this peculiar sounding woman. And in the bureau, he basically just suggested that we kind of look into it and start calling the number. So we did. And the rest is history.
And the rest, as they say, is history. So Michael is talking to this woman and notices something odd, right?
Right. I mean, she has this not a tinny voice. I mean, it sounds like a normal woman, but repeats herself over and over again. And Michael starts asking her questions like, what is the vegetable in tomato soup? Yeah. To which she doesn't know the answer, just kind of laughs. And she was trying to get you to sign up for health insurance.
He asks her at one point, point blank, whether or not she's a computer, right?
Right. Michael did ultimately just say, are you a robot?
And?
But she won't answer that question. Well, she'll say, I'm a human.
This is just weird. because she wasn't. We have some of the tape, so we'll listen to it. And here he goes. Here's what it sounds like.
What? No, I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, that's crazy. Esther, you just sound so much like a robot.
I am a real person. Maybe we have a bad connection. I'm sorry about that.
Will you tell me you're not a robot? Just say I'm not a robot, please.
I am a real person.
You did get a live body at one point, right? You called back enough times, you talked to somebody, and they said what?
That's right, we did. Michael called back. He called back twice. The first time he called back, he got a live body, and the person just said, "We don't use robots," and then hung up the phone. And then he called back again, and I guess they had, you know, a long, cordial conversation. The guy on the other end didn't actually know a whole lot, I think, about what the company was. He just suggested that if we did a story about it, we put their URL in the story on the website, which we did.
Which you did, PremierHealthAgency.com, which is now dead, right? It's a dead link, and the number is dead. I mean, this whole thing has been vanished like the bookie parlor in The Sting, for crying out loud.
Yeah, like a ghost. And where is Samantha West?
I don't know. who do you suppose the woman is who recorded those tracks, right?
Oh, yeah. Who knows? I mean, yeah. There's obviously a real person. If you're listening, Samantha,
call us.
I'm sorry.
You're out there somewhere. The ultimate goal was to get you to buy some kind of insurance, right? Life insurance, health insurance, some kind of something.
That's right. I mean, that's as I understand it, they say that they work with all these insurers and they want you to sign up for health insurance. And the first questions are, are you signed up for Medicare and Medicaid? And if you say you're not, then they want to, you know, sign you up for some other health insurance program. Who knows how that would go? I mean, judging by the fact that the whole thing went offline after the story went up, I wouldn't trust them to insure my children if I had it.
Not a reputable agency. Denver Nix, he's a reporter at Time.com. Denver, thanks a bunch.
Thanks a lot.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today in which James Bond is revealed to be not much more than a lush. A group of doctors over in the UK sat down and read all 14 Bond novels, noting each and every martini, drunk, shaken, not stirred, of course, over the course of the 88 days depicted in the books. 007 had the equivalent of 5 vodka martinis a day, which the doctors say would have left him impotent and near death. Think about that on a Friday afternoon, because that's Marketplace from APM. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. It is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.